an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks, right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear, right? And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something, like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025,
right? Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come soon, if it hasn't already.
Yeah, I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI. And so that's kind of, I don't know, I like a use case where kind of you kind of have thoughts as a human and then you use AI as a mode to try to, you know, get them out there more quickly.
Yeah.
Or iterate on them more quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at, that things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah. Like, it's weird.
You could teach a 5-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult, but you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things. I think, I forgot who it was, maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence where the point is it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things, right? And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case or to deal with that or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing? So one example might be like multiplication, right? Like you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication, right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator, like maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it? Or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay. And it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are even high-ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that, especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that value will kind of like circumcede any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how to use it, it takes us even longer to realize why it might be good or bad, and then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype, everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like maybe drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. We're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last whatever year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible. Or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar where kind of right now everyone is using it. And in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly. It'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think this is, if this is going to happen, very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks.
Peace.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I will also end the government policy of trying to socially engineer race and gender into every aspect of public and private life.
1 week ago, the Trump administration issued a 2-week ultimatum for all schools, universities, and colleges to end all DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or risk losing all their federal funding, as called for by the authors of the right-wing blueprint, Project 2025.
I am opposed to the Department of Education because I think it's the Department of Critical Race Theory.
With a 2-week deadline, will universities surrender or resist? We'll speak with education scholar Juan Vasquez Heilig and Yale University philosopher Jason Stanley, author of Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Then, as Trump shares an illustration of himself wearing a crown and writes Long Live the King, we'll speak with The Lever's David Sirota on how Trump has been ruling through executive orders and Doge. He asks, how are the Democrats resisting? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House has warned Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop criticizing President Trump and sign an agreement to hand over $500 billion of rare earth minerals and other resources as payment for U.S. wartime aid. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz made the threat from the White House briefing room Thursday.
Zelensky publicly rejected this deal about the rare earth minerals. Where does that stand?
Well, we're going to continue to have, he needs to come back to the table, and we're going to continue to have discussions about where that deal is going.
This comes after Trump lashed out at Zelensky, mocking him as a dictator without elections in an error-riddled rant on social media. Zelensky met in Kyiv Thursday with Trump's envoy to Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, but canceled a scheduled joint press conference after the talks. The U.S. has objected to a draft of a G7 resolution calling Russia the aggressor in its invasion of Ukraine. Separately, Reuters reports the U.S. is refusing to co-sponsor a U.N. motion backing Ukraine on the third anniversary of Russia's invasion. Meanwhile, Russian forces have advanced within 3 miles of the Ukrainian region of Dnipropetrovsk. On Thursday, a Russian missile killed at least one person, wounded three, when it slammed into an apartment high-rise in the city of Kherson. And the International Atomic Energy Agency is warning the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is currently operating with only one off-site power line due to fighting near the complex. Israel's military dropped leaflets across the Gaza Strip on Thursday, openly threatening the territory's entire population of more than 2 million people with forced displacement. the message, written in Arabic, references President Trump's mass expulsion plan with a threat to, quote, impose forced displacement upon you, whether you accept it or not, unquote. The message also read, quote, the map of the world will not change if all the people of Gaza disappear from existence and no one will ask about you, unquote. This comes as Israeli officials are casting doubt over whether a prisoner exchange set for Saturday will proceed as planned after Israel claimed one of the four bodies handed over by Hamas Thursday was not the body of hostage Shiri Bibas. Hamas says the remains appear to have been mixed with other human remains taken from the rubble left behind by Israeli bombardment. Israeli President Isaac Herzog called it a shocking and horrific violation of the ceasefire agreement, and Trump's special envoy for hostage affairs, Adam Boehler, threatened Hamas with total annihilation. Hamas is due to release six living Israeli hostages Saturday in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian captives held by Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's ordered a stepped-up military operation across the occupied West Bank after three parked buses exploded in Bat Yam near Tel Aviv. No one was hurt in the blasts. The Trump administration's imposed sanctions on a Rwandan top official and a senior member of an armed group over their backing of M23 fighters in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The U.S. Treasury Department announced the sanctions Thursday, targeting Rwandan Minister James Kabarabi and Lawrence Kanyuka Kingston, a member of the armed coalition Congo River Alliance, which includes M23. Both men are accused of being central to M23's operations as the group carries out gross human rights abuses. The Treasury Department said in a statement, quote, today's actions underscore the need for Rwanda to return to negotiations under the Angola-led Luanda process to achieve a resolution to the conflict in eastern DRC, unquote. To see our coverage of the Democratic Republic of Congo, go to democracynow.org. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum is warning the United States against any violations of Mexico's sovereignty after the Trump administration designated several drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. President Sheinbaum said Trump officials should refocus resources on investigating groups that are operating and laundering drug money inside the United States. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has not ruled out threats of military action against cartels. This is Mexican President Sheinbaum speaking to reporters Thursday.
El pueblo de México, bajo ninguna circunstancia,
the Mexican people will under no circumstances accept interventions, intrusions, or any other action from abroad that are detrimental to the integrity, independence, or sovereignty of the nation, such as coups, interference in elections, or violations of Mexican territory, whether by land, sea, or air.
The terrorist designation also includes the MS-13 gang, which is predominantly based in El Salvador, and Tren de Aragua in Venezuela. Trump has made false claims about the group's potential threats, wrongfully accusing all asylum seekers and immigrants of being gang members to fuel a racist agenda. The Trump administration said Thursday it had abruptly deported at least 177 Venezuelan immigrants who'd been detained in a newly constructed prison camp at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Dozens of the Venezuelan immigrants who were forcefully transferred to Guantanamo were accused without evidence of involvement with Tren de Aragua, as Trump claimed to be targeting only the worst of the worst. But recent reports showed many of them had never been convicted of violent crimes. Venezuela's interior minister was at the airport outside Caracas when the U.S. deportation flight arrived on Thursday.
The United States says that there are people from the Tren de Aragua gang and criminals. We checked the first group that they were said to be from Tren de Aragua, and there was no one from there, not one. We are going to check the legal situation of each one of them. Those without a record will go home, and we will take them, and we will take them with care.
Asylum seekers and immigrants have described torturous conditions while on U.S. deportation flights, including being shackled at the ankles, waist, and wrists for hours. This comes as The Guardian reports the corporate conglomerate Acima, charged with running Guantanamo's immigrant detention camp, has been accused of gross human rights abuses over conditions at three other immigration jails it oversees. President Trump has rolled back a Biden-era program granting temporary relief from deportations to an estimated 500,000 Haitian immigrants living in the United States. Gerline Joseph, the executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, told the Miami Herald, quote, slashing 6 months of protection while Haiti faces rampant insecurity and a humanitarian crisis is nothing short of a death sentence. This is racism in policy form, and we must resist it at every turn, she said. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ordered the Trump administration to comply with his previous court order to at least temporarily unfreeze foreign aid funding. But U.S. District Court Judge Amir Ali stopped short of holding Secretary of State Marco Rubio and acting USAID Director Pete Morocco in contempt of court. Among the many programs impacted by the freeze are HIV and tuberculosis treatment, maternal and newborn health care, and humanitarian aid to 2.6 million people in northeastern Syria. The emergency response rooms in Sudan, a civilian aid group, said the aid freeze is already worsening famine and the world's worst refugee crisis, with a spokesperson telling the New York Times, quote, a week of not finding food would actually mean a lot of death, unquote. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. Thursday denied a request by unions to block the efforts by Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency to drastically slash the size of the federal workforce. In his ruling, U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper acknowledged the mass firings have already caused disruption and chaos, but said the issue should first be adjudicated by the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Earlier this month, Trump fired the FLRA chairwoman, Susan Sway Grunman, whose tenure was not set to end until July. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has detected H5N1 bird flu in rats for the first time in a Southern California county where two recent poultry outbreaks were reported. The discovery comes as the USDA is seeking to rehire bird flu experts recently fired by DOGE. Meanwhile, a newly published CDC study finds two dairy workers in Michigan may have infected their pet cats with bird flu, and that one of the infected cats likely passed the virus on to other people. The results of the study were supposed to have been published in January, but were delayed by a blanket pause on CDC communications ordered by President Trump. Billionaire Elon Musk took the stage Thursday at the 2025 Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., known as CPAC. Musk was welcomed to the far-right gathering by Argentina's President Javier Milei, who gifted Musk with a chainsaw to celebrate DOGE's efforts to shrink the federal workforce while gutting entire government agencies.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy. Chainsaw!
Also appearing at CPAC Thursday were Vice President J.D. Vance and Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. The Senate has narrowly confirmed Kash Patel as director of the FBI, replacing Trump's former pick, Christopher Wray, who resigned his post just ahead of Trump's inauguration. Patel is a Trump loyalist, far-right conspiracy theorist who previously called for the FBI's D.C. office to be closed and the next day turned into a museum of the deep state. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin spoke out against Patel ahead of Thursday's vote.
It is shocking that my Republican colleagues are willing to support him, despite the serious threat he poses to our national security. And I'm sorry to say I believe they will quickly come to regret this vote. When I think of giving this man a 10-year tenure as director of the leading criminal investigative agency in the world, I cannot imagine a worse choice.
Patel's confirmation came on a vote of 51-49, with Republican Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski voting against him. Vice President J.D. Vance, who was across town attending Thursday's CPAC conference, was not needed to break a Senate tie after Kentucky Republican, former Senate leader Mitch McConnell, voted in favor of Patel's nomination. McConnell announced Thursday he would not seek re-election in 2026 when his term expires. The Senate has approved a $340 billion budget blueprint to fund the first part of President Trump's agenda. The resolution passed on a largely party-line vote of 52-48 after a marathon overnight voting session known as a Votorama. It includes $175 billion for border operations and mass deportations, as well as $150 billion in new Department of Defense spending. This comes after the House Republicans unveiled a draft budget proposing $4.5 trillion in tax cuts and at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, including to Medicaid and food assistance. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions voted along party lines Thursday to advance Linda McMahon's nomination to serve as Education Secretary, bringing her closer to heading the agency President Trump has repeatedly threatened to shut down. McMahon is the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. She and her husband, Vince McMahon, were recently sued for failing to stop a WWE ringside announcer from sexually assaulting young boys. New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced Thursday she will not invoke her authority to remove embattled New York City Mayor Eric Adams from office. Adams is up for re-election this year and faces a crowded primary in June. Murad Awada, president of the New York Immigration Coalition, said in response, quote, Eric Adams sold out New Yorkers to avoid prosecution for corruption charges in a quid pro quo deal with the Trump administration, plain and simple. Now he's working with the Trump administration to separate families in New York City in direct violation of our local sanctuary policies. All New Yorkers will face real and dire consequences from Governor Hochul's refusal to hold the mayor accountable for his actions, he said. Protests are planned for Saturday at noon in Washington Square Park to demand Mayor Eric Adams' removal from office. Here in New York, Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, will appear in a Manhattan court today as he faces murder and terror state charges. This is Mangione's first hearing since his arraignment in December. A trial has not yet been set. Officials at the Vatican say Pope Francis's health is improving after the 88-year-old pontiff was hospitalized for double pneumonia and asthmatic bronchitis. But for the first time, cardinals acknowledge Pope Francis' resignation due to his ailing health is a possibility. And today marks the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, one of the most influential political figures of the 20th century. Malcolm X was shot dead as he spoke before a packed audience at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, February 21, 1965. He'd just taken the stage when shots rang out, riddling his body with bullets. He was 39 years old. Two of the three men convicted of Malcolm X's assassination were exonerated in 2021 after decades in jail and decades of advocacy on behalf of the men, Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam. And after a two-year investigation by the Manhattan DA's office and the Innocence Project found the prosecutors, the FBI, and the New York Police Department omitted key evidence around the murder. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's given K through 12 schools and universities a two-week ultimatum to end DEI, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion initiatives, or risk losing federal funding. In a letter sent on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1 week ago, to school administrators, the Education Department barred schools and colleges from, quote, using race in decisions pertaining to admissions, hiring, promotion, compensation, financial aid, scholarships, prizes, administrative support, discipline, housing, graduation ceremonies, and all other aspects of student, academic, and campus life, unquote. The Education Department has already canceled some $600 million in grants focused on training teachers on critical race theory, social justice, and other related topics. Meanwhile, the department's Office for Civil Rights has also declared race-based scholarships, cultural centers, and even graduation ceremonies illegal. The president of the American Council on Education, which represents more than 1,600 colleges and universities, said in a statement, quote, "There's nothing specific enough for us to be able to act on in 14 days unless we just wipe the slate clean." He added, "Overcompliance, anticipatory compliance, preemptive compliance is not a strategy. The strategy needs to be much more considered, much more nuanced," unquote. This comes as Trump's pick to head the Department of Education, Linda McMahon, cleared a committee vote Thursday, and her nomination now heads to the full Senate, where it's expected to be approved. Trump has told reporters he wants McMahon to dismantle the Department of Education.
Why nominate Linda McMahon to be the Education Department Secretary if you're going to get rid of the Education?
Because I told Linda, I hope you do a great job and put yourself out of a job. I want her to put herself out of a job, Education Department.
Linda McMahon is the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment and a major Trump donor. During her confirmation hearing earlier this month, she was questioned by Democrat Chris Murphy on Trump's order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI.
My son is in a public school. He takes a class called African American History. If you're running an African American history class, could you perhaps be in violation of this court order, of this executive order?
I'm not quite certain, and I'd like to look into it further and get back to you on that.
For more, we're joined by education scholar Julian Vasquez Heilig, professor of educational leadership, research, and technology at Western Michigan University. His new piece is headlined U.S. Department of Education's 14-day ultimatum on equal opportunity. Will universities surrender or resist? He also helped organize the coalition defending the freedom to learn and served leader with the NAACP on education and other issues. Thanks so much for being with us. It's great to have you here. Professor, can you start off by talking about the response a week ago on Valentine's Day when university and college presidents across the United States got a letter that said NDEI, and I want to ask you exactly what that means, in 2 weeks or lose all of your federal funding. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars across the United States.
Right. Well, first of all, Amy, thank you so much for having me on your show. Just glad to join you. I want to say that I think that the higher education community, also the K-12 community, understands that this letter from the U.S. Department of Education doesn't carry the force of law. We do know, of course, that what's happening in Washington, D.C. is that they're using resources, finances as a lever. So we've seen, for example, funding from the NSF, from the NIH, IES, at Western Michigan University, for example, we've lost $20 million in grants in the College of Education and Human Development. And so they're really using the power of the purse to attempt to enforce these different, abolishing the Department of Education with this letter. But I think it's been really bewildering to K-12 and higher education, which my understanding is the goal. I mean, the Office of Management and Budget, the director there, has said that's really the goal of this blitzkrieg is for all of these requests to be bewildering. But I know in higher education it's been very difficult, and so you have cabinets, presidents, provosts trying to understand what are going to be the impacts of this. You could see six-figure, seven-figure, eight-figure reductions in research funding. Our attempts to find the cure for cancer, to solve the teacher shortage, to create more efficient energy, all those things are under threat because over the last 100 years or so, higher education has seen large investments from the federal government. And historically, those investments, that search to solve the teacher shortage and create more efficient energy, et cetera, they didn't come with strings attached. And now institutions, higher education institutions and K-12 districts are facing millions of dollars in reductions if they don't pause DEI. Now, you mentioned in your lead up, what is DEI? And I think it's important to talk about what DEI is actually. DEI is not reverse discrimination. What DEI does is, as educators, and I taught fourth grade, I taught ESL, I've taught college students, doctoral students, what DEI does is it helps us to create more success for historically marginalized communities. So we want to ensure that African-American students, that they, when we bring them to our campus, that we graduate them. Latino students, students with disabilities, veterans, it's a wide spectrum. And so I think it's important to understand that DEI is not reverse discrimination. It's our attempts to ensure success for all students on our campus, close those gaps, those equity gaps in graduation rates, in retention rates. That's what DEI work does. That's why we have Black graduation ceremonies or Mexican American graduation ceremonies. We want to create the climate. We want to create the opportunity for students when they come to us in higher education, when they come to us in our K-12 schools. We want them to be successful. We want all students to be successful, whether they're Jewish or have disabilities, et cetera. That's what DEI is. And so it's not about reverse discrimination. It's about student success, faculty success, staff success.
I want to go to a 2023 video on Donald Trump's campaign platform website in which he proposes taking, quote, billions and billions of dollars that we'll collect by taxing, fining, and suing excessively large private university endowments to create what he calls the American Academy.
Whether you want lectures or ancient histories or an introduction to financial accounting or training in a skilled trade, the goal will be to deliver it and get it done properly using study groups, mentors, industry partnerships, and the latest breakthrough in computing. This will be a truly top-tier education option for the people. It will be strictly non-political, and there will be no wokeness or jihadism allowed. None of that's going to be allowed. Most importantly, the American Academy will compete directly with the existing and very costly four-year university system by granting students degree credentials that the U.S. government and all federal contractors will henceforth recognize. The Academy will award the full and complete equivalent of a bachelor's degree.
I mean, this is very significant, Julian Vasquez Heilig, that Trump is proposing an alternative American education system. We already know what happened with his Trump University. He was successfully sued for this for-profit college. But talk about what he is proposing, the American Academy.
So first, I want to say, and then I'll directly address the question. First, I want to say that universities are not ideological. So do we have folks on our campus who are on the right or on the left? Do we have students who are on the right, on the left? Do we have students who are apolitical? Absolutely. But universities are not ideological. They're places of learning. They're the places where the difficult conversations happen. So I think that's the first thing to say. All of the politicians that you see making pronouncements about universities, they all attended universities. Some of them, the elite Ivy Leagues, the president and vice president, for example. So I think that's important to say. I think the second important to say is that this is expected. I want to take you back in history, okay? Be a scholar for a moment here. If you think about the dictator Pinochet and what he did after he took over the country of Chile, he understood that as a part of the autocratic playbook, that you have to privately control and privatize education. And so you see a push for this in K-12 education right now with school vouchers, which is that we want education to be privatized. It's not a public good. And so what you see here, I believe, is an attempt to privatize education. And I'm sure it'll be for profit. And, you know, he didn't speak to that. And so this is a part of that sort of classic playbook, because when something is in the public realm, it's a public good. And so what you see here is really an attempt to privatize education is by all indications.
I want to go to Russell Vogt, head of the Office of Management and Budget, who was architect of Project 2025, the radical playbook to seize executive power, radically reshape federal agencies. Last year, undercover reporters with the Center for Climate Reporting recorded Vogt discussing his plan.
I am opposed to the Department of Education because I think it's the Department of Critical Race Theory.
That was Vogt speaking on television. I want to go now in response to the threats to DEI programs and LGBTQ outreach from the Trump administration to the president of Mount Holyoke, Danielle Holley, who recently said to basically comply with things that are not within our values simply because we feel a threat of investigation is something that we should not be doing as the higher education community. Instead, we need to just say no. Here's what we stand for. We will continue to stand for this. And if you believe that you can legally challenge our mission or our values, that's up to you to try to do. The president of Mount Holyoke said, who herself is African-American. Julian Vasquez-Heilig, if you can tell us what is happening right now across the country, this whole idea of obeying in advance and, you know, because of the very real threat of losing so much money and funding that'll hurt the very people that these university presidents are trying to protect.
Yes. First, let me just address Vogt. So, you know, he also said, we want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. When they wake up in the morning, we want them not to want to go to work, because increasingly we want them viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down. We want them to be put in trauma. So I think that helps us understand the blitzkrieg from political actors right now. Is that they really want to put higher education in trauma. That's almost a direct quote from Vogt. So I think that helps sort of contextualize. Now, we have some difficult decisions to make as higher education leaders, as K-12 leaders, some very difficult decisions. Because, as I mentioned, over the last 100 years, universities have become very dependent on solving the world's issues through research. And so that means there's millions of dollars that the federal government has been providing without strings attached. Well, now there's going to be strings attached. But who's to say that diversity is where these conversations stop? So what if after diversity, the question is, well, we don't want you to have unions, or we don't want you to have a college of fine arts because we don't think that that's appropriate. And so when there's strings attached, so universities have to make two decisions. One, there'll have to be courage, like the president of Mount Holyoke or the president at Wesleyan in Connecticut, or two, patronage. So in talking with some folks, some scholars at the University of Michigan yesterday, there's really those two choices for higher education institutions. And so there's a side where we're going to have to innovate and rethink how higher education is funded. Or we're going to have to succumb to a system of patronage where the federal government, you know, in 4 years, a Democrat might come in as president and say, you won't receive federal funding unless you have DEI programs. So that's really the road we're headed down. And then I think one final thought, which is that when we hire leaders in higher education, we typically look at their pedigree. Did they go to Harvard or Berkeley or Stanford? What were they, department chairs or deans? But now we have to have additional criteria when we're selecting our leaders, our deans, our department chairs. It involves courage. It involves morality. It involves empathy. So we need special kinds of leaders in this very difficult time. I would argue that higher education hasn't faced a crisis like this since potentially McCarthyism. And so we need a different kind of leader to address these modern challenges also.
And finally, are there lawsuits being planned? There's 1 week to go after this letter.
Yeah, well, there's already multiple lawsuits. For example, my understanding is that the NIH funding has been paused in court from a report that I read from
The freeze has been paused.
Yeah, the freeze has been paused. Yeah, exactly. So there is. I know that the APLU and the AAU So these are the conglomerates of the different kinds of institutions that they're involved in litigation too. I suspect that you'll see litigation from civil rights community. And that's part of the strategy for educators. And, you know, I think it's important for us to understand that academics, educators, we have to create alliances with students and engage in political and legal advocacy and research and document and publicize how these things are actually impacting our institutions and who they're impacting. And then I think it's also one final thought is that we have to leverage our professional associations, our organizations, accrediting bodies. There's a reason why accrediting bodies are also being targeted, because accrediting bodies set the standards for universities. So it's very important that we create these coalitions. And so that as this pressure continues on higher education and K-12, that we can respond, because the number one priority of our institutions is student success. And I don't believe, my argument is that none of this is in the best interest of students.
Julian Vasquez-Heilig, we thank you so much for joining us from Kalamazoo, Michigan, professor of educational leadership, research, and technology at Western Michigan University. We'll link to your new piece, U.S. Department of Education's 14-day ultimatum on equal opportunity. Will universities surrender or resist? Up next, erasing history. How fascists rewrite the past to control the future. We'll speak with Yale philosopher Jason Stanley. Back in 20 seconds. The Interrupters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to someone who has a deep understanding of the stakes of the Trump administration's assault on education and history. In his latest book, Yale University philosophy professor Jason Stanley details how educational institutions and the teaching of history have become key battlegrounds in authoritarian countries, as the Trump administration, through a dizzying series of executive orders and actions, attempts to dismantle higher education in the United States by redefining discrimination in schools, fighting so-called woke ideology, attacking diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, gutting the Department of Education, and threatening funding for research and higher education. We're joined here in New York by Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale. His latest book, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future, also author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I mean, since your books, you've been writing a lot, and you've been speaking a lot on these issues. If you can take on what's happening right now to the major threat to higher education, whether we're talking about the freezing of funding for pediatric cancer research throughout the United States is some of the most elite scientific departments at universities, or whether we're talking about erasing DEI. What, give us the context for this.
Well, first of all, there are no liberal arts colleges in authoritarian countries. So if you're transitioning to authoritarianism, you have to target colleges and universities as well as education. As Vladimir Putin recently said, wars are won by teachers. Now, let's be clear. The United States has the world's greatest system of higher education. Everyone in the world who can sends their kids to our colleges and universities if they can be accepted to those universities. Every professor in the world would leave their university if their personal situation would allow to come to a U.S. university if they got an offer. What the Trump administration is trying to do is take this system down. They have various reasons for take. They have various excuses, not reasons. They say universities are packed with Democrats. Well, look, math and physics departments are packed with Democrats. The vast majority of mathematicians and physicists are, in fact, not Trump supporters. So the idea is presumably to stock your local physics department, to stock the top medical schools with Trump supporters just because they're Trump supporters. This takes down the United States as a leading research place. It takes down one of the things that we do unquestionably the best in the world, which is higher ed.
Talk about how exactly you see history being rewritten by the current administration and the impacts it has in your university and others.
Right. So they're targeting, they say they're targeting critical race theory. Critical race theory is the study of the practices that keep racial inequalities present, that are hangovers from Jim Crow. The institution for example, things like mortgage redlining, school segregation, housing segregation, policing practices that were formed when cities were intentionally segregated. So they're targeting black history, they're targeting minority history, and they're trying to replace it explicitly with patriotic education. Now, in just imagine your cartoon vision of an authoritarian country. Imagine 1984. It's a country, the George Orwell's book. It's a country where students pledge allegiance to the flag every day. It's a country where instead of knowledge and learning, they're taught to be, they're indoctrinated. Now, this will be done supposedly under the banner of classical education. The idea is we're going to restore classical education to end wokeness. But let's look at classical education. Classical education is an education that is whose foundational elements are the works of the ancient philosophers and ancient history, like Thucydides, Plato, and Aristotle. Plato advocated removing children from their family at birth. In Plato's Symposium, it's normal to have relations between older male professors and their younger male students. So the idea that classical education is there to promote Christianity and the nuclear family is simply just delusional. And it's, as usual with this attack on schools and higher education, it's merely an ideological facade for replacing critical inquiry with, saluting the flag.
So talk about this moment. We're talking to you on Friday. You're both a German citizen and a U.S. citizen. You're the son of Holocaust survivors. You don't throw around these words, fascism, Nazism, easily. You know exactly the effects. We're moving into a weekend, an election in Germany. If you can talk about Vice President J.D. Vance recently meeting with the far-right party, Alternative for Germany, AfD leader Alice Weidel. Billionaire Elon Musk sent a message to the AfD's election campaign launch party back in January, which he says there is too much of a focus on past guilt. I want to play that.
The German people are sort of a really, really an ancient nation. It goes back thousands of years. Julius Caesar's account of like first encountering the German tribes in the Gola campaigns, and he was like, "Wow, it's very impressive. these are very, very powerful warriors." I think there's like frankly too much of a focus on past guilt, and we need to move beyond that. Children should not be guilty of the sins of their parents, or even let alone their parents, their great-grandparents, maybe even.
So that's Elon Musk addressing the AFD on a huge video screen. And of course, as we just said, Vance just met with the AFD leader. The election is Sunday. Talk about the significance of this.
So in discussions of, for example, black education, Germany is held up as a model of facing its past. And Germany's sort of democracy has been based upon this education system of facing the past. Now, it was always somewhat fictional. We have to remember that 80 years ago, Germany, we're talking about 80 years ago. We're not talking about the 19th century. So Germany had various ways of facing its past and various ways of evading facing its past. But across the world, it was taken as a model. So if you take down Germany's education system, then you take down the world model for doing this. Now, let's be clear. German people of my generation, their grandparents were Nazis. We know now that the Wehrmacht, the German soldiers who fought the ordinary Germans, we know now through research that they participated in mass slaughter. Seven of my great uncles were murdered by the Wehrmacht, and all of their children, my mother and her sister, are the only survivors of their family, of their generation. So this education, flawed as it was, is being targeted now. AfD is running on a platform of glorifying German soldiers in World War I and World War II. That comment of Musk, the German nations were great fighters, that links into AfD's rhetoric and propaganda of reversing, of erasing the past, saying, well, we should be proud of our German soldiers in World War I and World War II. Now, this was always going to be the case. If you attack black history in the United States, if you blur the history of slavery, if you say that slavery was part of what made America great, we don't need to be ashamed of it, that is, of course, going to result in the erasure of Jewish history in Germany. And, you know, Jewish Americans, my fellow Jewish Americans who supported this in the case of black history, erasing black history, this is just coming back to bite them. Musk is not American. He's not from America. He has no commitment to Holocaust history being remembered. This kind of facing your past, as Germany shows, is essential to democracy. It's essential to German democracy.
You know, the Nazi Party was founded in Munich. 100 years ago this week, on February 27, 1925, Adolf Hitler delivered a speech to 3,000 people in a Munich beer hall just out of prison for his role in a failed coup. He was relaunching the party and cementing his role as its unquestioned leader. But also, out of Munich, Hans and Sophie Scholl, that brother and sister who attended the University of Munich, they weren't even Jewish. They were Christians who felt that the world and Germans had to know so that they could never deny what was happening with the Holocaust and release those six pamphlets, among them the one that said, "We will not be silent." They would be caught, captured, tried, and beheaded, along with their professor and others. So if you can talk about what resistance means.
So let's be also clear that the attack on universities is due to the fact that universities are centers for defending democracy. Students have always been, since World War II, the anti-war protesters. They protested Vietnam. Last year, they protested the war in Gaza. They protested the Iraq war. So you have to target universities because, as Bangladesh showed, that the students can overturn, are the main enemies of authoritarianism. The Weiße Rose, the White Rose, they showed that students, they were students, and they showed how students provide the center of resistance. And that is also a central reason why authoritarians attack universities.
So as you look at what's happening in this country right now, when we talk about the erasing of history, do you see a preemptive acquiescence that is taking place? And as you heard our last discussion, what do you think university presidents should be doing? We quoted the president of Mount Holyoke, but actually, very few presidents have spoken out right now.
That's right. It used to be that our presidents were supposed to speak out in favor of democratic values. Now university presidents are being told, oh, you have to preserve your institutions. Guess what? Universities are core democratic institutions. Preserving your institutions means speaking out for core democratic values. If you're not speaking out for core democratic values, you're not protecting your institutions, which are core institutions of democracy. So you might have an institution that has the same name that's still called Yale University, but it is no longer that institution.
Jason Stanley, I want to thank you for being with us. Author and professor of philosophy at Yale University, his new book, Racing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Also author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And we'll link to your articles that you have written in response to what's happening right now in this country. Coming up next, the head of the lever, David Sirota, on what the Democrats are doing to resist what is taking place or what they're not doing. Stay with us.
I am a dove. I sail above the rivers and watch them. And as I fly, the season sigh, tell me where clouds come from tears and years and atmosphere, that's where the clouds come from.
Julie Felix. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 1 month into Donald Trump's second presidency, he's mostly governed through executive orders and carried out his agenda with sweeping cuts by the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, the billionaire, and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency. All of which has generated a slew of protests, lawsuits, judicial rebukes. This week, Trump shared an illustration of himself wearing a crown with the headline, Long Live the King. It looked like a Time magazine cover. As he cheered his administration's move to end congestion pricing in New York. On Tuesday, Elon Musk defended his work to gut whole agencies across the federal government in a joint interview with President Trump on Fox News.
I think what we're seeing here is the sort of the thrashing of the bureaucracy as we try to restore democracy and the will of the people.
Meanwhile, a court filing from the White House Office of Administration lists Elon Musk as a senior advisor to the president who's serving as an employee of the White House office, not Doge, which the White House previously said he was leading. To discuss this and much more, as Elon Musk holds up a chainsaw at the CPAC summit that just took place, we're joined by David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, former senior communications advisor and speechwriter for Bernie Sanders. His recent pieces for The Lever are headlined, Trump just limited your payout for airline mishaps. Elon doesn't want you to know his DEI past. And Musk just scored more government cash while pushing education cuts. Well, you're here for a big podcast convention. You were talking about climate. But talk about what's happening right now and the level of resistance.
I think what we have to understand is that the question that we have to ask is, why is Donald Trump behaving the way he's behaving when his party already controls Congress and the courts? What is the point of trying to do what he's doing without going through the normal process of legislating? Right? If you want to close down the Department of Education, if you want to close down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the way to try to do that is through legislation, through passing it through Congress, having the law upheld in court. His party controls those institutions. So why hasn't the White House tried to do that through the normal process? And I think if you step back, what you see is what they're trying to do is create the precedent that a president can do whatever a president wants, that it's not a co-equal branch of government, that essentially it is a king, an elected king. And I think they're relying on the idea that people, or at least their base, doesn't necessarily know or care about what the difference between a president in a co-equal branch of government is versus an elected monarch. They're trying to create a precedent that presidents cannot be constrained at all.
And your response to Elon Musk saying we're talking about the thrashing of the bureaucracy as we try to restore democracy. I mean, you watch Fox and all they're talking about is laughing about people getting doged. They're cutting the fat out. You're not hearing about what the services are that are being slashed, sliced and diced across this country.
This is an old tactic. This reminds me of the Gingrich era. Newt Gingrich, when he rose to power in Congress, would come out and pick out one or two science projects that sounds on its face ridiculous. Oh, the government's spending $2 million to study cow flatulence. Oh, this means that the entire government is wasteful. Meanwhile, there's a reliance that there's not an understanding of what scientific research ends up developing. And I think they're applying that across the board. And we have to ask the question, well, why? The richest man in the world is also one of the largest government contractors. So there's an inherent conflict of interest, or in the case of the Trump administration, I guess, an alignment of interest. The more you cut public services, the more it creates essentially the impetus to hire private contractors, and the guy who's doing the overseeing of the cutting happens to be one of the largest private contractors.
You recently said in social media, quote, it's not really a political party at this point. It's better understood as a country club with status perks for its emeritus leaders. And referring to the Democratic Party in response to news that former VP presidential candidate Kamala Harris had signed with CAA to represent her on her post-White House initiatives, including speaking engagements and possible book deals.
Look, the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be interested in changing, at least not yet. They reelected their same leaders who oversaw the policy and party positioning that led to Trump's reelection. That's the same leadership that led to Trump's first election in 2016. The party doesn't seem interested in changing how it approaches its own voters or its own effort to win elections. There's some lip service to the middle, to the working class, but there's not really a change in policy.
What do you make of Senator Sanders now going around the country and speaking in red districts that are most vulnerable? He says if we can turn around three, he says, they've ended their extremely narrow lead in the House.
Yeah, look, I think Bernie Sanders is doing the right thing. It's an example of what the Democrats at large should be doing, which is actually going into and trying to speak to the disaffected working class that used to be the base of the Democratic Party. The problem is that the Democratic Party, its leaders are caught between the demands of their donors and the demands of voters, which is why so often the Democratic leadership sounds incoherent. If you're trying to address what voters want, but also trying to enrich or appease your donors, you often sound like you stand for nothing. I mean, can we actually explain or answer the question, what do the Democrats stand for right now, other than, in theory, rhetorically being against Trump, even though they're giving votes to confirm some of his nominees? I think the average person has trouble even articulating what is the Democratic Party for? What does it support? What does it advocate for? There's not really much of an answer right now.
You had a recent piece on Elon Musk's previous support for DEI policies at Tesla.
Yeah, well, look, only a few years ago, Tesla was touting itself as weaving DEI into its DNA. That's a quote out of a large report that came out from Tesla. Obviously, the politics have shifted. Donald Trump is trying to demonize DEI as a way to appeal to the working class. And the Democrats haven't made an effective argument on economics to also try to appeal to the working class. And right now, if both parties aren't really making an economic appeal, then Trump is relying on making an identity appeal.
In this last 20 seconds, what do you think is most important right now?
The most important thing is for the Democrats to try to gum up the works, to stop what's going on. They don't have a lot of power. And it's also important to understand that if Donald Trump is going outside of the institutions of government, then the Democrats are going to have to rely on different kinds of tactics that don't just rely on just press conferences in the U.S. Senate.
Do you think it's possible Republicans in the House and Senate will turn on Trump?
I don't believe it's going to happen. There's no historical precedent for the Republicans to bail out on their own president.
David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever. We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will link to your articles at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
You are listening to WRCT-FM, broadcasting at 88.3 and also available to you on the internet at WRCT.org. In just a second, Pinckney Hall will be beginning. Good morning. Kenny Joe here. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. You just heard the Holy Modal Rounders, Steve Weber, Peter Stampfl, doing Bully of the Town, a tender little ditty authored by Vernon Dalhart. What we're going to be doing for the rest of today on Pinckney Hall, we do this, I don't know, maybe every other year. John Fahey had a birthday, or will be having a birthday in a few days. And in my own personal opinion, he had a big influence on what you're hearing today. Not today on WRCT, but hearing today generally. He also is someone who whose music helped me through a troubling time a long time ago. But so we're gonna honor John Fahey today. We might even play a song or two by John Fahey, but most of what we're gonna play are music that influenced John or is related to John in one way or another. I might like playing 60 minutes of John Fahey, but I'm not sure my audience does, and I even heard a rumor that that causes internet copyright issues. So